Good evening, friends. Franz Weinschenk here to welcome you to another edition of Valley Writers Read, a program where Central California authors get a chance to read their stories. And you know what? We've got a real treat for you tonight. Jim Ashford, a writer we've had on many times, will be reading a story of his entitled Capital Follies. You know, Jim is an attorney and for 30 years served as the legal counsel for our legislature up in Sacramento. Here he is reading his story, which remembers many of what he calls capital follies. Ladies and gentlemen, Jim Ashford.
That, dear listeners, is the official song of the state of California. Written in 1913, lyrics by a Los Angeles merchant named Francis Bernard Silverwood, and melody by Alfred Frankenstein. Or maybe that's Frankenstein. Anyway, the recording you heard is also from 1913 by Elizabeth Spencer and the Knickerbocker Quartet. And I don't think the song has been recorded since. Small wonder, since the melody and lyrics don't exactly have the pizzazz of, say, California, Here I Come, or California Girls. But it's the official state song. Says so right there in Section 421.7 of the California Government Code. That's the same part of the Government Code that decrees that the official animal of the state is the California grizzly bear. Section 425, if you're looking it up. And the 1913 sheet music for the song, I Love You, California, featured a grizzly affectionately hugging the outline of the state. And what does all this have to do with this essay? First of all, let me confess, I do love California, for all its faults, seismic and otherwise. I'm a second-generation native, born in 1940 into a state that generously nurtured me and multitudes of others through a public educational system at that time unparalleled in the world. That journey culminated in my enrollment at the University of California at Berkeley, an institution I love and cherish. Berkeley, the lair of the golden bear, the California grizzly, Ursus Californicus, gave me 7 of the best years of my life and 2 degrees, raising up this poor lad from the Central Valley to professional esteem and reward. And I was so grateful to the state I loved that I chose to enter public service to the state, to give back, as it said, in thanks for the grace given me by California. But now, another confession. Parents, ask your children to leave the room. Are they gone? I confess that I took the blessings given me and became a lawyer. I'm retired now, a recovering lawyer. It's been more than 10 years since I last practiced, and I'm doing fine, thank you, one day at a time. But for 30 years before, for my entire professional life, I represented one of the few occupational groups that in the Gallup poll consistently ranks even lower in respect than lawyers. I'm talking about legislators. And who ranks even lower than legislators? Lobbyists. So it's the three L's at the bottom of the spectrum: lawyers, legislators, and lobbyists. And I was one of that loathed trio. Worse, I worked for and with them. Them being the members of the California legislature and the lobbyists who attend them. How could this be? A nice boy from the Central Valley winding up like that. In my shop, back in the day, we had a variation on the old joke. There's this guy who tells his family that he plays piano in a whorehouse in Sacramento because he's afraid to admit that he's a lawyer for the legislature. But you know what? I loved every minute of the time I spent in Sacramento, all 30 years, for four reasons. It was public service. It was fun. It was intellectually stimulating. And most of all, my clients and those around them were the most weirdly fascinating people on earth. Entering the halls of the state capitol was like falling down Alice's rabbit hole. You never knew exactly who or what you might run into, but you knew it would be fascinating at best and loopy at worst. Actually, it turned out to be the kind of work that I would have invented if it hadn't existed. My job worked this way. I was a state civil service employee working for the California Office of Legislative Counsel. This was a group of about 40 lawyers established almost a century ago to provide strictly nonpartisan legal services relating to the legislative process. In other words, we drafted the bills and amendments, gave formal legal opinions on issues of constitutionality and other matters relating to legislation, and sat as legal counsel to the members and committees of the legislature. And occasionally, we'd do litigation for the legislature as a whole. So, we were the legislature's lawyers, and we were absolutely, positively nonpartisan. By law, we couldn't care about policy. We just had to make sure that a policy was legal, or at least tell the legislature if it was not legal. We couldn't refuse to draft a bill or amendment, even if we thought it was unconstitutional. If the members were determined enough to pass something like that, it would be for the courts to pass on it. And we maintained the attorney-client relationship with each individual member. That is, by law, we could never divulge to anyone information that a member had given us in our capacity as legislative counsel. And that restriction did not end with my retirement. So, at this point, let me make it perfectly clear, to borrow a phrase from a famous California politician, that nothing you will hear in this essay violates that sanction. It's all either public knowledge or just my personal experiences with the behavior of the members and not their official secrets. Now, if I could have breached confidentiality, this essay would be a lot longer and much, much juicier. I will leave it at that. Recall that I said that our office wrote the bills for the California legislature. If you have ever been under the impression that the members actually write the thousands of bills introduced each term, you are misimpressed. Fact is, the members would come up with an idea, or a constituent or lobbyist would whisper in their ears, And then the members would talk to us, and we would put the idea into proper legal form. So, when you hear a member talk about, quote, a bill I authored, end quote, translate that to, quote, a bill I kind of thought up. There was even a question at times whether the members actually read the bills after we prepared them, and they came up for a vote. I'm not being overly cynical here. One prominent senator, H. L. Richardson of Southern California's 25th District, now retired, actually wrote a book entitled, What Makes You Think We Read the Bills? You could look it up. Senator Richardson was one of the more colorful members of the Senate. For instance, he made the news back in 1973 when he got into an altercation just off the floor of the chamber with Senator Milton Marks of San Francisco and Marin. And he punched the senator out. Heavens! Senator Marks survived and immediately returned to the floor of the Senate with a copiously bleeding cut lip. But he wore his wound like a badge of honor, saying in a later interview, quote, I put a bandage on my lip and I wore it for a month. The same bandage. I changed it once in a while, but just to annoy Richardson. Senator Milton Marks, incidentally, was a very nice guy, known around the Capitol as Uncle Milty, who was a consummate campaigner, maybe more so than many others. An editorial in the San Francisco Chronicle following Senator Marks' death in 1998 said, quote, Marks never stopped campaigning. He seemed to be everywhere, a genial presence with outstretched hand, always happy to meet a new voter. It was said whenever three or more people gathered in San Francisco or Marin County, one of them was sure to be Milton Marks. He was a ubiquitous presence at weddings, wakes, bar mitzvahs, parades, ribbon cuttings, and every manner of gathering, public and private. He'd attend the opening of an envelope, said one admirer. His adversary, Senator Richardson, was an outspoken politician, a conservative who founded the Gun Owners of America and wore a sidearm around the Capitol, as did one of his aides, a man named Norm Moore, a delightful former L.A. cop and acquaintance of the best-selling crime author Joseph Wambaugh. Norm would occasionally drop by my office to tell war stories about the mean streets of Los Angeles. He was right out of a 1940s Warner Brothers Cops and Robbers second feature. I liked Norm, and the bulge under his suit jacket never bothered me. Not that you needed to carry a gun in the Capitol, but as anyone who has paid attention to the news over the past 40 years knows, suspected or actual white-collar crime was periodically an undercurrent in the legislature. From time to time, the FBI would descend on Sacramento in a lightning war against supposed corruption among the elected. Agents uniformly dressed in blue suits, white shirts, and plain red or blue ties would show up with search warrants, surprising certain legislators in their offices and scaring the hell out of them. When that happened, a legislator, staring wide-eyed at the blue suits and probably remembering every transgression against truth, justice, and the American way he might have committed since kindergarten, would put in a panic call to my boss. And my boss would call up some of us other lawyers with instructions to show up to make sure the legislature's interests were protected. Now, please note, we weren't there to protect the member. Under law, our office couldn't represent an individual member involved in a criminal investigation. We were there, instead, essentially to make sure that the member didn't do anything stupid, like promising to make other legislators' records available to the agents. We always made sure that both the member and the FBI understood our limited capacity. From a lawyer's point of view, it was pretty dicey stuff, especially because many of the members in question seemed to think that just by our being there, we were becoming their criminal defense counsel. And you know, I was never treated by a legislator with more respect and deference than in those moments with an FBI agent sitting across the desk. For some reason, best known to the FBI, but probably having to do with the in terrorem effect, these raids always seem to happen very late at night toward the end of a legislative session, when the houses were droning through backed-up last-minute bills, and everyone, including we lawyers, had been working for 14 straight hours. But at least our role as defenders of the right ended when the blue suits departed and a targeted legislator could find private counsel. And of course, some of these late-night confrontations did result eventually in indictments and trials. And some members did end up doing time. My impression was that the convictions always seemed to fall on those members whose work-related interactions with me or my colleagues in the office had been uniformly rude, officious, snarky, irrational, and sometimes stupid. An example. I was once tasked to render an opinion on a procedural matter in a committee meeting. I gave the legal answer, and one member, who was on the losing side of the argument, confronted me after the meeting, backed me up against the wall, poked his finger in my chest, and shouted, "What's your name, Sonny?" I figured, of course, that this was a veiled threat to have me fired for coming down on the wrong side of what was essentially a political argument. But since I was an employee of the state of California, not of the legislature, it was an empty threat. So I just pulled out my wallet, gave him my business card, and cautioned him that the accent in my last name was on the first syllable. How sweet it was. And I did not mourn when, some years later, that same member went from the state house to the big house, convicted of extortion of an undercover FBI agent. The crooks were a tiny minority, but they were almost always known to the discerning eye of other members and staff. There was one senator, for instance, whose demeanor even before his election raised eyebrows. It appeared to everyone breathing that he hadn't lived in the district from which he'd been elected. His sole contact there was an empty rented apartment with a telephone billed to his name. And later, as he made his way through his legislative career, he gave the impression to many that there was not a corner he wouldn't cut. And his personal reputation with most of the members was, to put it mildly, poor. A capital joke was that you should wear a hazmat suit if you went to his office. I once had the opportunity to watch this guy completely clear a room just by walking into it. It was a late-night committee meeting, and the members had broken for takeout dinner in the Senate lounge, and there was a terrific NBA playoff game on television. All the committee members and staff, and yours truly, were noshing and watching the game, which was tied, with a couple of minutes to play in the final period. And then the senator in question walked in and sat down. He didn't say a word. But suddenly, every legislator present got up and left, followed by every staff person, leaving just me. The senator didn't seem to notice. He was just munching on a sandwich and watching the game. So I got up and left, too. In time, few in the Capitol were surprised when that senator turned state's evidence in a corruption trial and ratted out some of his other colleagues, a lobbyist, and another state official. What a guy. He did his time and is now, I understand, owner of a mall in Oklahoma. Sometimes the threat, real or imagined, of an FBI sweep would have touching consequences. One assemblyman, who always seemed to believe that he was next on the FBI's list, would periodically come to my office, close the door, and, beset by fears of indictment, ask me to pray with him for relief from prosecution. Law school had prepared me for a lot of things, but requesting divine intercession on behalf of a client wasn't one of them. I'd compromise and close one eye while he made his heavenly petition. Nevertheless, either his prayers worked, or he was never under a cloud in the first place. It turned out that while he might have had a guilty conscience, he was never the subject of FBI interest, and is, I am told, happily retired someplace far away from Sacramento. But aside from iniquity, there were many other reasons to stand in amazement at some of the legislators' antics. There was, for instance, the assemblyman whose entire legislative program seemed to consist of preparing and sending out or personally delivering commendatory resolutions to constituents. Maybe you've seen some of these. They're highly stylized and colorful printed memorializations of the real or imagined accomplishments of the honored individual. They're covered with state seals and the signature of the awarding legislator. Gee, even I have one of them, awarded upon my retirement, which commemorates my years of sacrifice and self-denial on behalf of the citizens of California, and perhaps also commemorates subliminal relief on the part of the legislature that I was finally leaving state employment. Anyway, the joke around the Capitol was that if you were from this guy's district and did not have a resolution hanging on your wall, you were either dead or had never registered to vote. One thing about legislators is that they are always campaigning. One time in the early 1970s, I had just boarded a flight out of Orange County, coming back from a committee meeting. And in a row in front of me was sitting then-Senator John Schmitz, he of the John Birch Society and contradictory family values. He supported two families simultaneously, neither knowing of the other. Anyway, just before the plane pushed back from the gate, another senator from Orange County, James Wetmore, came on board and started walking down the aisle of the plane. Now, Senator Wetmore was very nearsighted and also notoriously vain, so he only wore glasses when absolutely necessary, which is to say, when he had to see something. Senator Schmitz called out, "Hello, Senator," and Wetmore, his political instinct sensing the presence of a constituent but unable to see a foot in front of him, went into full campaign mode. "Well, hello there. It's always good to meet folks here in the district, and I'm honored," etc., etc. And he's coming down the aisle closer and closer to Senator Schmitz, and he's babbling away about how hard he's working for everyone in Orange County. And then he gets right in front of Schmitz, blinks, and says, "Oh, hi, John." When I started with the Legislative Council in 1969, there were no term limits. And many of the members of the legislature had been serving for years beyond what today's limits would permit. This was good and bad. About the good, more later. About the bad, a consequence of too many consecutive terms could have the effect, among some members, of convincing them that they had been anointed, not elected. This could lead, in turn, to some pretty regal behavior that often extended beyond their tenure in office. There was, for instance, Senator Randolph Collier from Yreka, who had first been elected to the legislature in 1938. Known variously as the Silver Fox of the Siskiyous and the Father of California Freeways, who in those days represented most of California north of Chico, he'd seen it all and acted like it. Very late in his life, a second marriage had happily resulted in a child, and one fine Sunday in the middle 1970s, I found myself in one of Sacramento's city parks, pushing my year-old daughter around in a stroller, and came upon the venerable senator, by now long retired from office, in the company of his infant child, also in a stroller. He recognized me as someone he'd seen around the Capitol. He nodded and said, quote, "Watch my daughter. I want to go across the park to watch some baseball." Not a request, mind you, a command. I just shook my head and walked on. Thank God I wasn't a political appointee. He'd probably have pulled strings with his colleagues to have me transferred to Yreka. I had spent 20 years working with legislators when the Term Limits Initiative passed in 1990. And one of the results of that initiative was a decline in the cohesiveness and productivity of the legislature, and a quantum leap in bizarre political behavior that I think crippled the institution. When California voters approved the initiative, I don't think they thought things through. It's the law of unintended consequences thing. You know, it was like what happened with Proposition 13. Remember that? Property taxes too high? Freeze them. Whoops, now there's no money for local government and schools. Go to the state legislature, hat in hand, asking for help. Local control? Diminished. State control? Enhanced. And as the years wear on, hideous differences appear in what homeowners pay for property taxes between those people who haven't sold their homes and those who have purchased a home since 1978. And the difference is growing larger every day. So it was with term limits. In a fell swoop, the lazy bums are thrown out, right? No. The members thrown out are those whose local constituents believed in them and in their performance enough to reelect them time over time. You know, as a Democrat with a small D, I think it's a terrible thing to tell the people of an assembly or Senate district that they can't return to office a person in whom they have confidence. The false promise of term limitations was that good citizens would, like the noble Roman farmer Cincinnatus, leave their plow in the fields and go to the state house to work for the common good, and then soon leave the state house, go back to the farm, and plant potatoes. It just doesn't work that way, because the political animal does not live a termed life. But the real problem of term limitation was the loss of institutional memory. When legislators were reelected by the people of their district, they had the luxury of long-term study and refinement of policy and programs. They and their staffs could spend time working proposals over to meet the objection of opponents while trying to preserve the merits of the plan. Consider, for instance, automobile emissions laws. Those were first passed in any version by California in 1960. That passage took years of work by legislators who had experience against the opposition of Detroit lobbyists who vowed on their mother's souls that the proposed requirements of emission control could never, ever be achieved and that the state and national economy would collapse. We all drive cars today that meet those standards, and more. And there hasn't been an economic collapse yet that resulted from automobile emissions controls. When term limitation kicked in, the institutional memory was lost. Novice legislators come in, they bring their campaign staff to become their legislative staff, and it's like children in Wonderland. They don't know any history of the institution. So where do they go for information? To my office? No, we were prohibited from advising on policy, remember? We couldn't tell them something like, well, this proposal was first raised in, 1960, and it was shot down for this and that reason and so forth. So where would the legislator go? Well, they go to the lobbyists, those circling sharks who have the real institutional memory. Lobbyists have been around longer than God, and so the legislators are at the mercy of these non-elected persons and special and self-interest groups for information about policy. I liked it better when there were fewer novices and more experienced men and women in the legislative chambers. The other unintended effect of term limits, in my opinion, was that those elected to the legislature no longer had a long-term interest in learning the job and performing it well. For instance, the assembly is limited to 3 2-year terms. In my office, we used to joke that a person spent the first 2-year term learning where the restrooms were, and the second and third planning to run for the Senate or the U.S. Congress. I ask you, how hard would you work at a job to do the very best you could if you were told on day one that you would be fired 6 years later, no matter how proficient and dedicated you became? The best argument against term limits was exemplified by my own congressman, George Radanovich. He was first elected in 1994 to a 2-year term in Congress. One of his campaign promises, truly a vow, was that he would serve only for 10 years and then return to his private life. And 10 years later, he reneged on that promise and vow, with the implication being that his experience and competence as a representative was simply too valuable to his constituents for him to refuse to run again. And you know what? He was right. His constituents kept returning him to Congress after the 10-year pledge had run out. And what's so bad about that? The people get to elect whomever they wish. I think that's what the representative democratic system should be about. But I do go on. Just a couple of more stories, and then you can let the kids back in the room. The legislators were not the only thing odd and fascinating about working at the Capitol. There was always the unusual or eccentric private citizen roaming the halls. My favorite was a wonderful old gentleman named Robert Simpson. Back in the late 60s and early 70s, he had an unresolved dispute with some Department of State government. The particulars are lost in time, I'm afraid. And he had taken to slowly shuffling through the halls of the Capitol with hand-painted placards attached to the front of his walker that excoriated the legislator or governor du jour, whomever he thought wasn't helping him in his cause. Space was always limited on the walker, so the messages, in bright red paint, were brief and to the point. "Unruh bastard," read one, referring to Jess Unruh, Speaker of the Assembly. "Mulford bastard," read another, meaning a cranky assemblyman, Don Mulford from Berkeley. And later, "Reagan bastard," meaning Governor You-Know-Who. No generous person ever took offense at Mr. Simpson for his signs. And he was probably more photographed by tourists than any legislator or governor. He had a crusty but delightful demeanor. After the above-mentioned Don Mulford managed to convince the assembly that Robert Simpson was a threat to the souls of the children of California because of his naughty signs, the Capitol Police regularly arrested him on some baloney charge, and just as regularly, scores of local lawyers would stampede to the Sacramento Municipal Court to represent Mr. Simpson for free. Robert Simpson never gave in until the day he died, and shortly before that happened, while he was patrolling the walk outside the Capitol on a foggy December day, he chanced to meet my daughter, Elizabeth, then a 3-year-old, dressed in Christmas season finery for a party and as cute as she could be. She smiled up at him, and he bent down to tell her how nice she looked. And if only I had carried a camera that day. The smiling old man with the white hair, the sweet little girl in the red velvet dress, and between them the sign, "Reagan, bastard." Let's end this on an even lighter note. The famous Isabella Caper. In the 1970s, I had the pleasure, and it was a pleasure, to be assigned to advise the legislature on legal matters concerning the renovation of the historic state capitol. I was even issued my own hard hat to wear around the project. If you've visited the Capitol since then, you might have an appreciation for the wonderful job that was done over several years of renovation by a dedicated team of engineers, builders, artisans, and artists. It's a beautiful space, worthy of the people and the state. But, of course, nothing is free from controversy when legislators are involved. Virtually every detail of the project ran afoul of the animosity between members of the Assembly and the Senate. It doubtless took years longer than it should have to finish the job because the clients kept getting in the way. And few details of the project raised more controversy than the question of what to do with Isabella. She, being the central figure in a larger-than-life sculpture titled Columbus's Last Appeal to Queen Isabella, depicting the Queen of Spain hearing a plea from the Italian sailor to finance his expedition to discover the east coast of India. The depicted historical figures and the theme of the piece have absolutely nothing to do with the state of California. Created by one Larkin Goldsmith Mead in the late 19th century, the work was given to the state by D.O. Mills, a Sacramento banker, in 1883. Mills was adamant that the center of the rotunda of the then newly built Capitol would be a dandy place for the statue. Actually, not so dandy. For those who care about monumental rotundas, and such people do exist, the whole idea is to be able to stand in the center of the floor and gaze upward to the dome in awe at the architect's and artisan's craft. This was not possible in Sacramento after Isabella came to sit in silent contemplation of Columbus's request for travel expenses, unless one sat in the Queen's lap, which some young capital jokesters have done late at night. Decades passed. When time for restoration of the historic Capitol came about, it was necessary that the statue be removed from the rotunda. There was general agreement among the architects and the contractors that Isabella eventually be placed elsewhere, anywhere, even perhaps outside the Capitol, for the reasons noted above, and for reasons of safety involved in the restoration plans for a public basement space beneath the center of the rotunda. But there was immediate political controversy. On the assembly side, led by the late Lou Pappin, chair of the Joint Rules Committee, the sentiment was to move Isabella out of the rotunda. On the Senate side, championed by then President Pro Tem James Mills, the sentiment was to keep her there. Open warfare, bitterness, invective, silliness. The native sons of the Golden West came in on the side of the assembly for California historical reasons. And Native American and Latino organizations weighed in for the assembly for more visceral reasons, not being big fans of the effect the discovery of the New World had worked on their ancestors. But after months of rancorous chatter between sides, the Senate contingent played their ace card, Italian-American pride. The horror that the Admiral of the Ocean Sea should be driven from the rotunda, thus, by association, defaming all persons of Italian descent living in California. Wasn't it bad enough that the Godfather had just won an Academy Award? So, the drama, or whatever it was, played out with historians, Native Americans, Latinos, and Italo-Americans beating up on each other. And the two houses of the legislature, as usual, were at each other's throat. Finally, the assembly contingent caved in. Isabella would be moved back to the newly renovated rotunda, and visitors would still not be able to stand in the center, look up, and say, "Ah." So Isabella came back, at the cost of not only the aesthetics of the rotunda, but at considerable additional cost to reinforce the floor of the rotunda so that the statue, which with its pediment weighs 9 tons, would not fall into the basement, obstructing entrance to the Capitol gift shop and the cafeteria, and perhaps crushing schoolchildren, tourists from Iowa, Native Americans, Latinos, and Italo-Americans. So, she is still there in the rotunda, and still the object of a popular game at the Capitol, pitching pennies into her crown from the second-floor balcony. The Isabella flap is instructive for what may become of another statuary gift to the Capitol. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's recent placement of a life-size bronze California grizzly bear in the public corridor outside his office. He spotted it in an art gallery in Aspen, see, and thought it would look good outside his door. Paid for it, had it shipped with his own money, didn't cost the taxpayers a cent, and it only weighs 800 pounds. Moreover, There is at least historical justification for the bear. As I said at the top of this essay, Ursus californicus is, after all, the official animal of the state, notwithstanding that Californians had killed off every single one of them by 1922. And Arnold likes the bear. And who wants to argue with Arnold over his taste in art? But he is no longer governor. By the time you hear this essay, the bear's place in the Capitol could well be the subject of controversy. One imagines our renovated governor, Jerry Brown, proposing that the bear be relocated to some other place in the Capitol, or perhaps removed entirely. This, he could say, will reduce wasteful state bronze bear expense, avoid species-centric insult to non-ursine mammals, or simply recognize, quote, a new era of bear limits. Whatever. But take a trip to the Capitol, and, as I have, observe the outpouring of affection for this noble symbol of our state. This golden bear of bronze absolutely delights children, their parents, and every domestic and foreign tourist who drops by the governor's office. School children already have rubbed the bear's nose and teeth to a bright sheen. Toddlers have hugged its great neck and, when the state police are not looking, hopped on its broad back. Hundreds of thousands of pictures have been taken, happy family memories created, goodwill spread throughout the land and across the seas, and eventually, if it hasn't happened already, someone will give the bear a nickname and it will stick. Perhaps Arnold. And if Jerry Brown or any subsequent governor attempts to remove the statue, the question will become, as it did in the case of Isabella, who will speak for the bear? Well, let's see. The Sierra Club, perhaps? Certainly a whole lot of kids and their parents. Tourists from Maine to Spain. And former Governor Arnold, of course. On the other side, who on earth would have the bad taste to dare to oppose the presence in the State House of this noble symbol of the California and the university that I love? Huh. Maybe the Stanford Band. You know, I think that golden bear is going to prowl the floors of the Capitol for a very long time. Go Bear!
Was Jim Ashford recalling quite a few stories and incidents about his time up in Sacramento when he served for 30 years as counsel to our legislature. As we heard, it's not the legislators, really, but the lawyers from the legal counsel's office that actually write the bills and laws that regulate our lives. Jim told us about some of the strange personalities and habits of a few of these legislators, like Senator Richardson and Senator Milton Marks, who got into a fistfight, with Senator Marks coming right back to the Senate floor bleeding copiously. Jim also remembers some of the investigations of various legislators. Inasmuch as legislators are constantly campaigning, Jim remembers how a couple of them persistently sent out congratulatory certificates and plaques to their constituents. The joke was that if you didn't have a flattering resolution from your assemblyman hanging on your wall, you were either dead or had never registered to vote. He also gave us a good rundown about the pros and cons of term limits and how a 9-ton statue of Spain's Queen Isabella made it into the center of the Capitol Rotunda. Well, Jim, you confirmed what most of us have suspected all along, that our system can still use a lot of help. Which brings to mind what Winston Churchill had to say about democracy. No one pretends that democracy is perfect or all-wise. Indeed, it has been said that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all those other forms that have been tried from time to time. Friends, Jim Ashford is one of the most prolific contributors to Valley Writers Read. He's been reading his stories for us for many years. Although he now lives in Fresno, he originally hails from Sanger and, as we heard, spent 30 years of his professional career as an attorney representing California's legislature up in Sacramento. Thanks, Jim Ashford, for your great story tonight. We hope you're working on another one for us for next year. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you would like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and link up with archived audio. Two authors next week, Lee K. Self and Natalie Chavez-Ruiz. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.